We had one patient. She was the first patient, I think, to take KIMMTRAK. Now, 7 years later, she is a CEO. She's done so many things. She has so many birthdays. That's really why I come to work every day. The company had a lot of rich history. Not always an easy one because it was the ups and downs.
Innovation, especially in biotech, is tough. I mean, it's never a walk in the park.
I'm so excited to be in this era still, you know, be part of this because we're going to see a huge transformation with AI in the drug development process.
I'm your host, Philip, and welcome to a new episode of the Flood Bio Show, where I interview the best Europeans in biotech to help you grow. Immunocore is the largest biotech in the UK and the fifth largest in Europe with a market cap of just over $3 billion. And since early 2019, Bahija is the CEO and we finally managed to connect and chat online. I've actually known Bahija since over 10 years, as I first read a profile of her in a pharma blog for students when I was studying bioengineering in France. And at that time, she was head of MedImmune and the SVP R&D of AstraZeneca. And she just has a remarkable track record. So in our conversation, we talked about how Immunocore changed the life of thousands of cancer patients and how it became a commercial biotech. We also talked about why Bahija thinks gender and race diversity is mostly a business case and how AI is changing protein and biologics engineering. So here's my conversation with Bahija, and please like, follow if you enjoyed. Welcome to the show, Bahija.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, it's great. It's great to have you. I want to start with Immunocore. I find the company really fascinating in many ways, and I've followed it actually since 2015, since the massive Series A. And one way that I find it fascinating is that, I mean, you really have changed the life of thousands of patients with a rare, basically eye cancer, thanks to innovative drug, named KIMMTRAK, which is a T-cell receptor, TCR, bispecific fusion protein. And what's also fascinating is that you managed to do that while owning basically the commercial rights, pharma partner, or at least sharing with a pharma partner. And you just reported revenues of, around $240 million for the whole year 2023. And I think that's the second year the drug is approved, if I'm correct. So I'm wondering, that's an amazing achievement. Can you share a bit how you actually feel about it?
Thank you. I feel great about it. And the most important thing is really a drug that almost died to bring it actually to patients. What was extraordinary about it is that these patients actually, once they're diagnosed with metastatic uveal melanoma, they literally have 12 months to live. That's what they tell us more and more, that when they are diagnosed, the doctor basically says you have to get your affairs in order. And to bring that hope for people, and we had one patient that came and talked to us. She was the first patient, I think, to take KIMMTRAK. And now 7 years later, she is a CEO. She's done so many things. She has so many birthdays and that's really why I come to work every day. So it is amazing what it's doing for patients.
Yeah, it's amazing. I saw actually you reported, I think, the 3-year data as well. And there was a, compared to standard of care, what was it? Was it 25%, around there, 25%?
Yeah, it's around 27%. That's what we saw. So we reported in New England Journal of Medicine the 3-year survival, which is really amazing for a disease like this. And it's still ongoing, but you can see the tail, what we call the tail, basically, at least 26 or 27% of patients still alive at 3 years, which was completely unheard of. I think what's also extraordinary is the fact that in 40 years, that's the first innovation in this space. And that is really satisfying.
Yeah, that's amazing. Actually, it, I listened to a podcast you gave on General Atlantic, I think it was in 2022. And you mentioned actually also on the clinical trial that basically at the prime at the intermittent readouts, the results were so positive that
right.
it was decided to basically stop the trial and go directly to the FDA for the approval.
Right.
Which actually I've actually never heard any biotech companies have that actually.
Yeah, you know, the end point was overall survival. And usually that takes a while to mature. So, you know, to just put it in perspective, we were still in complete COVID time, if you will. We finished the trial randomizing patients in June, and the first interim analysis was in October. And we basically internally said, you know, the probability that that's going to hit in October is very, very low. And we were extremely surprised that not only it hit, but the hazard ratio was 0.51, which was really amazing. And we did two things that I'm really proud of. One is, of course, we went to the FDA to have, you know, to agree on the BLA and so on. But the other thing is, because this is such a deadly disease, even as a small company, you know, we opened the what we call the EAP, so an patient's assistance program, because we could not wait until it's approved by the FDA and the EMA and everything to make it available for patients. So we started helping patients right away, which I'm very at no cost at that time, which I'm very, very proud of.
Wow. Did you, can you, just from a context, are there other biotech companies who had that recently of like stopping a trial, like having a trial going to markets after interim data analysis?
I don't hear too many of that. And sometimes the interim analysis is not really public. You know, you don't tell the market when you're having the interim analysis. So usually people don't talk too much about it, but it's not a usual thing. So it was a powerful drug on the overall survival, which I think is really amazing.
Yeah, that's great. And now I think one of the main priorities for this year is the commercial rollout of KIMMTRAK. I've seen that. From my understanding, you are managing most of the commercialization yourself. As I mentioned, you don't have a pharma partner, but you do have a partner for the commercialization of medicine pharma for some geography, Central Eastern Europe, Israel, Canada. But then you manage basically the biggest market, I guess, is the US that you manage yourself. And then, so how do you, what's your plan for the, like, for the coming, let's say, months for the commercial?
Yeah, so I think, you know, so we chose to commercialize ourselves for two reasons. You know, one is, you know, we believe we can. We have a great team, and it's not, it's an orphan drug. So usually, I think from the capabilities point of view, it was the first time, and we thought we can do it. The second thing is, this is a new platform, and I am a firm believer that we continue to learn. We continue to learn in the clinic, and we continue to learn in the market to bring that learning back into the early, you know, as we bring more products. So the goal this year, like you said, we had a nice growth, you know, quarter on quarter. So the KIMMTRAK is the standards of care in first line, which is amazing in the US and in Europe as well. And so going into the year in the US, we still have some growth in the US to happen. So we are now going more, you know, you start in the academic setting first, and then you get into the community. And, you know, the US is very big, so the community is very spread. So we need to continue in the community. And then in Europe is, as you know, it's country by country. So we had a really great success in Germany and France. Italy, and we just announced the approval or the reimbursement discussions with Spain. So we will be launching in Spain this year. So we'll get more countries in Europe, and we'll continue that way.
I'm curious on this topic. I mean, market access in Europe is definitely tricky for innovative drugs. On the podcast with Marc de Garidel from Abivax, and formerly from Ipsen, and he mentioned that most of his market was in the US just from a reimbursement point of view. I'm curious for you guys, I mean, especially Kimmtrak, I don't know the exact pricing, but I guess it's pretty high, I guess in the six figures, I guess. So how is the discussion there in Europe?
Yeah, so I think it's notorious that US is still paying for innovation, you know. So I would say that, we price Kimmtrak for the value it brings, because frankly, overall survival is the gold standard. Several drugs that in Europe, they don't get reimbursed if you don't have the overall survival, for instance. So we have absolutely the gold standards. We had two scientific evaluations, one in Germany and one in France, and we got one of the, you know, the high marks for the scientific. Yeah. Basically, everybody sees the value of Kimmtrak, but it is, you know, the U.S. is still paying for innovation. Europe is country by country. I think we got a very good, price in Germany. But we are still in negotiation country by country. That's the tedious part, I think, about Europe.
You disclosed the price you get with Germany? Is it public?
Yes, I think it was disclosed. It was $10,000.
Okay. And then how does it compare to the U.S. then? I mean, U.S. is a bit complicated with all the insurance.
So the US is right now is around 20,000.
Okay, so that's actually okay. Yeah, no, I'm curious because I also read especially in France there was I don't remember exactly, but there was a group of professors, an oncology professor, I think, especially around the professor in Lyon and Claude Bernard, where they were quite like upset about the access to innovative oncology drugs for patients, and that there were some, at least in their opinion, some reports where the scientific evaluation was basically lowered to influence then the reimbursement or to justify not reimbursing some drugs, and that would be then the patient could not access it, or even on a special request in the hospital could not access it. So I was curious how it compares with you when you have really outstanding data. Does it translate then to really positive? But it sounds like it's the case.
Yeah. So in France, where we had the assistance program, which is there is a pathway for that in France, and they pay for the EAP right away. It's called AP1 or something like that. It's a new system, but we are still negotiating the price now with France. So we're not done. These negotiations just take a little bit longer. Yeah.
As things can do in France. I'm not... let's switch a bit to the topic to technology. I think, it's a TCR, basically TCR receptor that you fuse of a fusion protein to some T cell activating, CD3 activating, at least for Kimmtrak. I'm curious, can you maybe expand a bit more, and especially how it differentiates from, let's say, a bispecifics typically? Especially one thing that puzzled me was on the targeting of antigens on the cell. I mean, why a bispecific couldn't target GP100 or the same antigen? I'm curious.
Yeah, no, it's a very good question. So, the important thing in the invention, if you will, is taking really what I would call always mimicking what happens in our body. So we do have the T-cell receptor, and usually it's really to differentiate between self and non-self, you know. So, and we took that property. The T-cell receptor is membrane bound, so we made it soluble. Soluble, stable. Usually it's also low affinity, so we increase the affinity a million times, and with keeping the specificity. And why this is important? Because the, well, the antigen is basically a peptide of 9 to 8, 9, 10 amino acids that's presented by the HLA, you know, so complex. So you have that complex is pretty short amino acid, so you have to have the specificity, and I'll come to that because that's where the differentiation comes from. On the other side is the CD3 that basically will bring any T cell that's you know, that has a CD3 receptor, any T cell will come. So we have, in one hand, we are binding to the tumor cell. That's basically our goal, is to identify the tumor cell, or you know, make it visible, and on the other side is bringing the T cells to kill the tumor cell. So the differentiation, and to your point, why on GP100 or on PRAME and things like that, you can't, so far, it's not possible to, or there are no monoclonal antibodies or antibodies specific to target. One of the attractiveness here is the fact that GP100, PRAME, and all that are intracellular proteins. And you know, monoclonal antibodies have access to membrane-bound or extracellular, you know, proteins. So these proteins, GP100 and or PRAME or any other intracellular protein, will be degraded, and when the peptides will be presented at the surface. So that's how we have access to intracellular proteins.
So the bispecific cannot like recognize it when it's degraded and presented on the surface.
It's
not specific enough.
It's not. So I'm not gonna say never. Right. So at least to say TCR mimics. So we call them the TCR mimics, if they're gonna happen or not. But the difficulty, if you will, the difference between monoclonals, basically they like or they see antigens that are non-linear, right? There is a conformation, and that's how you have the binding of the monoclonal antibody. Here we're talking about very linear, you know, 8 to 9 amino acids linked to the HLA. And what we know is the T-cell receptor needs to bind to both at the same time to recognize. So the HLA, and it's very, very linear, very, you know, it's not a conformational change or anything like the monoclonal antibodies. So at least so far, the T cell receptor is made to recognize HLA complex antibodies, less so. But I'm not going to say it's impossible.
Yeah. Okay. This makes sense, and now I also understand, because I saw the slide or the figure of that you can target, let's say 90%, or the 90% of the antigens that bispecific or T cells cannot target on the so because you can access basically all these kind of small antigens in different conformation. That makes sense. I have two questions or two things that comes to my mind. Is one is, what about basically alternative scaffolds or have proteins or nanobodies? I mean, we had the CEO of ex-CEO of Ablink was just a previous guest. So I guess with the nanobodies, maybe you can target different conformations, and you can also do basically bispecifics or even...
Yeah, that's why I said it's not impossible. I think the best thing right now is the T-cell receptor, right? Because we understand it really well and everything. I think there is another feature that I for a differentiation that I didn't talk about, is the fact that we can target down to 5 to 10 copies per cell. Monoclonal antibodies, as we know them right now, you need 1,000, you need a higher expression, right? And that's really crucial. Like I said, it's not impossible to have a TCR mimic. I really don't believe that's, you know, I just think the technology is not ripe enough, but it's going to be possible. I just think it's always possible, but it's not as straightforward, and you need a much higher expression of the target.
Okay, because that's the second. I saw that also as a transition to PRAME, that one of the biggest, let's say, competitor or someone by the company exploring is Immatix, also European company, German based, and they are using bispecifics. No?
Correct.
Yeah. Okay. But they are earlier than you, I believe, in the trial, or still in phase one exploration. Okay, so we'll see in the results how well it works, I guess, and how specific theirs are.
Exactly.
And maybe as a also transition to PRAME, can you like talk a bit more about it? I mean, it's basically the rest of your pipeline, and from my understanding, it's a much it's basically targeting solid tumors, has a much larger patient group as well.
Yeah.
Can you maybe talk?
Yeah, no. So GP100 is very much a melanoma protein. It's expressed only in melanoma. And we have now what we talked about, the whole data in uveal melanoma, but we have a trial ongoing in cutaneous melanoma. So there, it's very much a melanoma-specific protein. PRAME is really exciting targets for multiple reasons. You know, one, it's more broadly expressed and in larger tumor types. It's also not expressed in normal tissues, which makes it very attractive, but only in tumor tissues. It's also what we call a negative prognostic marker. So that means, you know, the way I look at it is tumors don't want to get rid of it, basically. And whenever it's expressed, it's more homogeneously expressed, which, you know, it's an advantage, basically. So, so for all these attributes, I think PRAME is very attractive. We also showed last year at ESMO, we showed that it's active. It's active in melanoma, uveal and cutaneous, and also we showed activity in ovarian, and we're testing it in other tumors as well.
And you're also in colorectal cancers, correct?
No, colorectal is on PWIL. That's another target. And so third target's coming to the clinic.
Can you, a bit personal, but my mom had colorectal cancer, so it's a bit also touching. And all the discussion we have is it's amazing that, so I can relate to it, and it's really working on other patients and with like heavy, heavy cancer, and you can have a transformative impact. I hope the rest of the trial goes well as well. I saw that you're working on infectious disease as well, but I think and looking also for functional cure, which in HIV, which I think is also amazing. But maybe we can switch a bit more to the team. From looking at, I mean, obviously you're coming with a MedImmune background. I think almost 10 years, I guess, at had 13 years. I've had a head of MedImmune, and just from at AstraZeneca. What I've seen is that quite a lot of people in your team also joined you. Or ex-MedImmune. Can you share a bit about this? Like, was it planned, or was it?
No, it's never planned, of course. I think the you know, to just close on what we talked about and the infectious disease and everything, that what attracted me to the company is really the technology is novel. It's real pioneer in this area, and also more transformative. You know, our goal is not to be just incremental, but to do something. You know, it's high risk, high reward, as I call it. That's why we're going into infectious disease, into not just controlling the viral load, but looking at, you know, can we actually get the functional cure? So every time you see us in something, it's really, how can we, you know, can we be transformational, not just incremental? And so I would absolutely believe that that's part of what attracted several people from MedImmune or from AstraZeneca. And it does help if you work with people before, so they know what to expect, right?
Yeah, I guess I guess they loved working with you as well. And
And I love working with them as well.
Love is usually reciprocal. That's nice. I mean, I find it always a great sign as a founder or CEO or manager, when your team wants to continue to work with you. I mean, even for me in the team now, Flood Bio team, actually most of the people are joining me from my previous startup, which I founded. Which is also great, and they want to work with. I think it's a great sense. Very nice. And maybe one word about also on the chairman of Immunocore, John Bell. But what is striking to me was that he co-founded the company, which dates back to like 1999 in some ways, as I think was Avidex at the moment. And he's still chairman basically now, which I think is a pretty like remarkable duration of being chairman. I don't know that many chairmen who last that long in companies who stay that long. How is it to work with them, and how is it how that you co-founded and it was chairman all the way along, how does that like play out?
So he's very unique, I would say, because he is not only on the science and everything, but also a really great entrepreneur, I would say, and great and understand, you know, the business really well. I don't think he was chairman all the time. I think the science started in his lab. He was, you know, affiliated with the company, but became chairman. I think just 2 years before I came or something like that. So James Nolan, I think, was the chairman before. But he is absolutely a fantastic person and also extremely supportive. And we have a great partnership, and I absolutely, the success of Immunocore, he absolutely should take a lot of credit for it as well.
That's nice. Maybe on the expanding a bit on the history of Immunocore. What was always also quite interesting is that PZP was like three different. It ended up being coming from three different companies, with at least there was Medigene in Germany. And Adaptimmune also, I think, also in Oxford.
Correct. They split at some point, yeah.
And split it at some point, but basically it's coming from the same lab, which is pretty amazing. But at the same time, Immunocore, I guess, went faster. I think Adaptimmune is a bit, it was more in cell therapy and in solid tumors. Like, how is it today, the relationship with the different companies, like?
So we don't, after Adaptimmune and Immunocore split, I think there's, after each one of the companies, one chose to go with cell therapy and we went with the soluble, we don't have nothing special as a relationship. Like, it's completely independent, two independent companies right now. So, as you said, the company had a lot of rich history, not always an easy one, because it was the ups and downs. And I think that's what happens in a new technology when you're pioneering something and it's completely unprecedented. So there's a lot of time to be invested in you know, bringing it to the level where it is right now. But in meanwhile, I think there was a lot of ups and downs, and you know, for the company. But hopefully, right now it's more stable.
I mean, innovation, especially in biotech, is tough. I mean, it's never a walk in the park.
Yeah, the shares and the patients.
Also, because I read more on the financial side, I think, I mean, Medigene was basically main shareholder, even of Immunocore, but at some point, I guess they were bought out. So today, they don't have any shares in the connection.
Another order minimum, I think.
Okay. Very minimum. And then, I mean, I remember what, I mean, that's one when I started really following when Immunocore were like kind of stood out on the map was in 2015 when they raised this like massive Series A, but I think it was the biggest ever in Europe and even on US standard, even today it's still really big. I think it was like $320 million. But at the same time, I heard you say on the podcast that it was a lot of money, but there was no strategy, something like this, and that it was mismanaged. Can you expand a bit on this? I'm curious.
Well, I can just say how I found the company, right? So I think, you know, and talking to investors when I took over, I think, you know, you raise money. It's for me, the philosophy of raising money, you really need to have before you go to raise money, what you're going to do with it, right? And raising 350 in a Series A, where the company, you know, again, I would say it didn't really have a plan and went through the 350, you know, more quicker than it should without the data. And I think that's the issue. So when I came to the company, the majority of the leadership team or the executive team has left. The company was just in not stable condition, I would say, from the governance point of view, from the science, which direction it should go, and so on. But I really, the positive thing and why I came, otherwise, you know, was the depth of the innovation, the platform. I absolutely believed in the platform, and saw the potential in KIMMTRAK. And, you know, I thought naively, you know, everything else I can fix, but it was hard fix. it was not easy. So thank goodness I was naive. Yes.
Sometimes naivety is good.
This is a blessing.
Sometimes, yeah. I mean, I remember at that time also from the fundraising. I mean, I think Woodford was involved and had raised this like massive fund, almost private equity, also early stage, but massive fund. And I remember talking with some investors, even some large French VCs, and they were all like super excited about the round. And I think it's one of the rare where like basically everyone wanted to join in at some point. Yeah. And I was like, okay. I mean, and they were very excited also. I mean, they were very excited by the platform, as in that it can be manufactured quite easily, yeah, that has amazing data or at least amazing potential, et cetera. On paper, at least it could look very big, right. But I guess, yeah, it's need to deliver afterwards. That's great. I think, yeah, and maybe to wrap up to wrap up on Immunocore, remember in the podcast you mentioned your dream was to build, I think, the largest fully integrated biopharma in the world. I think it was
I think I'll start with the Europe and we go from there. But yes, why not? I think we have. You know, when I look at the platform, like the questions you ask, you know, how would you do that and why would you do that? Well, the first thing is we have the science and we have the platform to do that, right? So we built everything from really strong research where we can bring more science and more targets. We have, the platform is modular. so we can be in cancer, infectious disease. And then in the last earnings, we actually talked about the third, we're at JP Morgan, the third possibility, which is in autoimmune diseases, you know, which is really an exciting area. So we have a big space to play in. Mm. We have a fantastic technology that's not just, you know, the bispecific is the start, I would say. We used CD3, we can use any other effector. So when you have a vast, space to play in, if you will, then I think that has, your ambition has to match that as well. So why not? I think we could. Why not?
That's great. I mean, yeah. Guess you will try your best.
Absolutely.
No, that's good. And maybe to go back on, I mean, that sounds super exciting also for you personally to join. I'm curious on that decision. So, I mean, as you mentioned, you could have gone somewhere else. I can imagine with your profile, you could have gone in many, many, many other places. Can you like walk back a bit on maybe the different options you had or how you came to that choice? Also, I mean, going for European company versus US based companies or staying in pharma, going maybe to a CEO position in pharma. I guess you had like many, many options. Can you like walk a bit through that?
Yeah, so I was lucky that I had several options, including, you know, staying in MedImmune if I wanted to. But I felt like I had accomplished what I needed in MedImmune. We had a great vision there, and I had a fantastic time there. I never had a development plan, as they call it in companies. You know, what do you want to be? Where do you want to be after? And so on. Because I'm somebody, if I put a goal on myself, I will try to achieve it. And I didn't want to do that, right? So I wanted to just, sometimes great opportunities come from the side, right? When you don't plan them. But one thing that was very important to me, you know, while I don't plan, you know, in 2 years, I want to be CEO or CSO or something like that. One thing I always know is I follow my heart, and it has to be whatever I do, the science has to be really interesting, you know, because that's my first motivation. If I don't like the science or if I cannot be passionate about it, I cannot do that. So, while I had a lot of different opportunities, I was lucky that way. This one where people really didn't understand at the beginning why you would go to this company, it was because of the science. And so I thought seeing that platform and what it could bring when a lot of people didn't believe, I think is what attracted me. Was it high risk? It was really high risk at that time, but it paid off.
Yeah. Look, it's always amazing when you look back at such a decision and it turns out to go well. I remember actually when I was following when Elliot Foster stepped down as CEO and then the CFO stepped down. Like, okay, and step down without any replacement, or like, I will support the board, something. I was like, okay. But then when you joined, I was also surprised, but I think, yeah, it turned out amazingly.
A lot of people were surprised. Yeah. I'm happy I did.
Oh, great. And I'm curious about development plan. I like that. And typically, not have many either. But I'm curious, now you still, like, I mean, you don't have a development plan or what's your, or where do you see yourself in the next, I don't know, five, 10 years?
Well, you know, we had a lot to do at Immunocore. I think we have a great platform. I think, you know, when I think about the next few years is, you know, hopefully bringing, still... Kimmtrak to more patients. I think, you know, if we do the cutaneous melanoma. We have one thing that I'm really passionate about is, you know, how can we get earlier and earlier and earlier in cancer and help people? So we have an adjuvant trial with the European organization that's ongoing for KIMMTRAK. That if we can, you know, bring this to patients even earlier, I would be, you know, really thrilled. You know, PRAME, if we can bring PRAME, you know, autoimmune infectious disease. So that's all I'm thinking about. And I think there's a lot to think about, a lot of unfinished business.
Yeah. It can keep you busy for a while. Like. Yeah. I get maybe, no, sounds good. If we can switch a bit to a topic, curious on you. I mean, as this podcast is also quite focused on, I mean, on European leaders in biotech, or at least leaders who have a pretty strong European connection. I think you, I mean, as you basically did your university studies and PhD in France. You grew up in Morocco, then PhD in France, postdoc in Germany. You moved to US for quite a while, but then coming now is a UK company. Can you, like, I don't know how, what were some of your lessons there, or how it helped you, or it helping you now?
Yeah, no, I was extremely lucky, you know, to have done all my schooling in France and my PhD in France. It really, you know, France for me was not only on the academic side, but growing as a person, you know, the cultural side, everything, which was great. Then going to Germany was, I would say it was my first time seeing, it was a test for me, you know, can you take what you did in PhD and actually be an independent, somehow more independent researcher? And there I really fell in love with the whole cancer research, I think was in Germany. And then, you know, the U.S. very much, you know, I had a really this very strong idea that, you know, pharma companies or biotech or whatever, we didn't know that time, they don't do science. If you go there, it's, you know, because it was more chemical companies. And so US really showed me that you don't have to choose between the two. You can do science, great science, to bring great drugs to the market. I think I learned a lot about biotech and being entrepreneurial. Definitely that entrepreneurial spirit more in the US, and that
especially in California, I guess, where it's strong,
completely at the hub of all biotech, and not being afraid to take risks. You know, people do encourage you to do that. You know, and now full circle back. You know, I see it again. I think in the UK you know, bringing this learning, all that I was exposed to, if you will, bringing it into the company. And what I see as the learning, I think, for European companies and everything is that Europe, and I see it now in the UK, have fantastic science, like absolutely fantastic science. I think you see in Germany started a few decades ago or a few years ago. And then in the UK, you have the startup arena is very strong, right? And you have more money to get a startup company. But then I think where it becomes less or more problematic is to mature these companies into a full-fledged, you know, industrial, you know, company. And that's because, you know, the appetite for risk is really less than in the US. Hopefully it's changing. Hopefully with the success of BioNTech in Germany and, you know, hopefully with Immunocore, you know, in the UK and things like that, that will encourage people to invest. Because then it's like a vicious circle. If you don't have that capital to grow the company, then you have less, you know, talents on the clinical side and so on that exist in the US. So I think that's the learning and the comparison between the two.
That's great.
That I bring.
That's great. Yeah. And talking about, I mean, what you mentioned in Europe, also now you have, I mean, luckily, but it was not only luck, but there are now a few commercial biopharmas or biotechs. I mean, Immunoco, obviously, but you mentioned BioNTech, Genmab, Argenx, doing, which are still like independent with a product on the market and a product on the market that makes good, like, but makes an impact and in the scales of whatever, hundreds of millions of revenues or even in the billions of revenues, which I think also brings, I guess, other people who have that experience that you just mentioned, and bring them to the rest of the industry. And I think it's great to see, and it happened actually pretty, I mean, obviously with a delay compared to the US, compared to the Genzymes and the Gentechs, but still, yeah, great to see. And also maybe just connected to the discussion we had previously, I'm always curious also, I mean, risk appetite for sure, capital appetite, but I'm also always curious on how much is it connected that the market in Europe for innovative drugs, as in reimbursement, and is so less good than in the US. How much is that, like, how much is that connected basically?
Well, it has to be connected, right? So if you look at the US, we always argue that pays for the innovation because, you know, we don't have in this business, the cycle for innovation or the cycle for R&D is much longer than the tech. You know, in the tech, the R&D is much shorter. And here you invest in, when I think about Immunocore, and we talked about the Series A and everything, that's been 20 years in the making, you know? So how do you...
And in the billion, over $1 billion invested before.
It's completely 20 years to come up with something that's completely novel. So yeah, it takes much longer, and you have to recoup that at some point, right?
Yeah, but definitely, I mean, But really compare, I mean, because I've seen even from inside on some European biotechs, and I mean, going to the US is basically mandatory, but it's still a big challenge and big friction, and you have to hire different team, different company culture, et cetera. And that's, I think, really not easy for European biotechs. I mean, always hard to quantify these things, but...
I agree. It's not easy, and I would say you cannot do it from Europe. Like, it's the same things. Like, if you get it commercialized, you have to have a presence in the UK, in US. You know, if you are dealing with more investors here, that was my thing with Immunocore. We needed to have a presence in the US because, you know, as I call it, out of sight, out of mind. You really need to be. I have access to talent as well. So we have a lot, most of the clinical is here, most of the commercial, we have a team in Europe. So I think we had to have the presence in Europe and in the US to accomplish what we needed to accomplish.
Yeah, no, but it's... Yeah, I remember we talked a bit with Mark de Garidel about this and about access when I mentioned him before, and he was also a bit on the political comment as saying, okay, I mean, you should also not be surprised too much as a government or the governments or the union. If you don't finance innovation, there's no market for it, that you don't have companies developing it and trying to develop it, or that you have champions in the space. It's you cannot have both, or like it's harder to have both. So yeah, that's maybe on another bit personal topic as well. On diversity. I heard you talk on the podcast, and I found it actually pretty striking that you're very open about it and very direct, like putting the words like which I found really like not a bit surprising, but also it really resonated, like, or it really resonates, and I find it, I really liked it. Remember you said something like, especially for gender diversity, it's not only fair, but there's a business case, which I find it's like, I mean, for the business, I liked it, but you didn't really expand on it. Could you expand on the business case, and especially how you measure it?
Sure. Yeah, no, I feel really strongly about this, because I think when we talk about diversity, we usually talk about it's not fair, we have to, you know, we have to be fair, we have to do these kind of things. And my view is, for everything, we bring a business case, why this is good for business, right? So instead of bringing it to the business as a guilt, you know, and making people feel guilty because they're not, we are actually not doing ourselves a service by not explaining why it is important, because
you bring it as an opportunity.
Exactly. And to say why it is important for your business to have the diversity of thought in general. When I look at where we are, it's in the business of innovation, right? And to be innovative, it's not having 10 Moroccans working with me that are women, are all the same, that went to France and stuff like that. We all have the same, you know, the same reference, the same cultural reference and everything. But if you bring people from different, if you look for that, you know, diversity of thought, you automatically going to have, you know, a diverse slate or diverse employees. My thing is, you know, there were studies actually in Nature showing that labs with more diverse, postdocs and PhD students produced more articles and more research than, you know, measured by the number of articles published than non-diverse lab. And I don't think we do enough of those kind of studies. So whenever you see me in talking to academics, it's like, you know, actually bring data. Because if you bring data, you're going to influence the change a lot more than if we just, you know, make people feel, you know, it's about fairness or guilt or something like that. It's really about why this is good for business. And I absolutely believe it is good for business. It's not easy. It doesn't mean it's easy, but it's good for business.
I like that. I would not challenge you, but where it's a bit hard is really making that case and having evidence to back that case, that business case. I mean, you mentioned the study, but how do you translate, I mean, academic output to, let's say, a company like Immunocore? It's got a different setting. And also from a personal experience, I really believe in this. I mean, I applied pretty much the same to my first startup and having really diverse hiring. I mean, more from a feeling and seeing that this brings us better products and we could give a better product for our users and that leads us to growth as a company. But it's very hard to like quantify and like put into, you know, like into really precise or more precise, like let's say bullet points or whatever, and then especially in the hiring, because you rapidly become and like being having to favor certain diversity in the hiring process to get this diversity, and I found that also not that easy to have a, like, let's say, more quantifiable approach there, or having some a bit more specific things. How do you go more granular?
I think there is more to it. I think you point your finger to something that's important, is we don't do enough of the studies, because I think it's really possible to actually quantify everything. I think for me is and we did that in my previous life, is we said, okay, we gotta, I want to have a really diverse, because it's so important for our business of the innovation, that we can be more productive, that we can be actually more, bring more, you know, drugs to the market. And the first thing was not to be counting how many or not, but to focus on the environment, right? Mm-hmm. Because if you want to attract different people and everything, they have to be in an environment where they can feel themselves. Mm-hmm. Because that's really the difference. You know, can you be, you know, in a very diverse setting? Most of the important thing is what we call the inclusion, right? Mm-hmm. So to have a diverse is have everybody can be themselves. And you cannot tell me when we don't feel ourselves that we are productive, right? When we have to be somebody else and or try to not be ourselves, you know, it's stressful. It's not great. But if you are in an environment where you can be yourself, you're going to produce your best work, right? How to quantify it? I think that's my always, you know, work for or appeal to the academics. You know, we need to focus on that instead we're focusing on numbers. You know, how can we quantify that innovation? I'm pretty sure, you know, I quantify it here. I quantified it in my previous life.
How did you quantify it at the RenoCall?
Okay. Is how productive we are and how, you know, the quality of the people we're attracting, which is really important. You know, if I can tell you, you know, some of it's the diversity here is fantastic. And we started from the board on to my leadership team, you know, as you have to lead there by example, but I can tell you, I quantify it by the quality of discussions we have, the challenges we have each other, you know, the innovation that I see every day. Right. But you have, it's not easy. I'm not saying it's easy, but you have to produce an environment where people can be themselves. And then it's a vicious circle. Like when people are feeling, you know, it's a great place to be, then they attract others and so on. And that's, I'm not saying we have all the metrics and how to measure it, but I can see the end product, you know, can we be productive in what we do, can we be better in what we do? And I'm still appealing to academics to focus on that versus the numbers.
Yeah. But even when you can, it's hard, you cannot basically A-B test, or you cannot really compare a less diverse RenoCall, what would you have delivered? I mean, I'm just challenging and playing the devil's advocate here, but
no, it's good. But that's the kind of discussion we need to have, right? Yeah. That's the kind of discussion that we need to have. It's not, see, the discussion would have stopped very quickly if I would just say it's not fair not having women, you know, 50% of this and that and whatever. But that's the discussion we need to have.
I found it actually personally, it's pretty difficult with the discussion, at least me as a, let's say, white male, is that like, yeah, I would have no legitimacy in bringing this topic of discussion. At least I'm perceived as having no legitimacy, and it's for it. But yeah, it's.
But see, I don't see it this way. So this is where I feel like we are all part of it, right? So part of why we believe diversity is good, right? Mm. And not it's for you white male to solve this problem. No, it's all of us, right? Mm. So I don't want the haves and have nots, you know, the have that feels guilty and the other ones is not. If we believe and we focus on that diversity of thought that is important, it's your goal.
Should everyone is responsible.
Mine as all of us to make it possible, because if we believe that that's the best for society in general, frankly, and for the work in particular.
Yeah. I like that a lot. I mean, and very. Yeah. I like that a lot, and I can see a more US also. I mean, more US mindset than US and what you are saying there. And it's something that I experienced. I mean, I finished my studies in Boston, and that's where I really could feel this like meritocracy. We don't care really where you're coming from, what's your color, whatever, exactly. What's your accent is about really more about your mindset and being aligned with everything and what you deliver, which, yeah, I found really good. And I remember in the interview you said when you came to France, you discovered how people were judged on the color of the skin, and that was pretty shocking.
Yes.
That's
Yeah, because I come from a country where we're all very different, actually. You know, if you think about Morocco, you have people who came from Andalusia, they were chased from Andalusia, you have the nomads in the south. They all look differently and they're all very different. So that was completely normal. And in Paris, it was very shocking, actually, that people were labeled with the color of the skin, you know, what I learned in Midwell.
Yeah, I think it's changing in France, but it could, there's a lot of work to do. And in general, in Europe. Maybe to finish on the last topic, a bit more on the, let's say, looking at the industry and overall. And you mentioned when you came to US, you were struck how you could do more biological innovation, not just chemical, also at pharma. I remember you were saying in one interview, you said that when Astra bought MedImmune, I think there was 5% of the pipeline was biological. In 2014, I believe, was 50%. I don't know what's the percentage now. I guess 80% plus.
Yes, higher.
But at the same time, lately, at least in the last 1-2 years, what was also curious to me was that quite a lot of small molecules brought amazing results, also a lot of deals. I find if I looked at it, it was a kind of small molecule was kind of going down and replaced by biologics, and now there's still biologic major. How do you feel about it on all that topic?
Yeah, no, I think, you know, so you saw with the small molecules, the degraders and other things. So the innovation, you know, started there as well. So I think, you know, I'm still passionate about biologics. I think there is still, you know, we're just mimicking what's happening in our body. And I think there's still a lot more to discover there. I think, you know, you've seen the antibody drug conjugate, for instance.
Yeah. Say no, it's merging.
Yeah, I think what I like, and that's what we do in Immunocore now, is really, you know, my message to everyone is, we need to start from a biological problem and have the tools to solve that problem, right? We should not be, you know, our technology is the start, but how can we take all the learnings and stuff to solve a biological problem? And I think what's fascinating in this era and fascinating in this, in where we are right now as an industry, is that there is really a huge toolbox of technology and to solve biological problem. And I think we are in an amazing era, frankly. So I'm still passionate about it.
Does it mean also that Immunocore, you are not closing to getting other technology tools? If it's
never
the best. Yeah, never.
Never. I think, you know, but you always, you know, go where your expertise is and collaborate and things like that. But we are really trying to tackle some difficult problems and hopefully have the tools to solve them.
That's nice. I think, I mean, what comes to my mind as a company that applies that pretty well is BioNTech, actually. Which always surprised me that they didn't start with mRNA at all, and now they have. I mean, I think they have even a PRAME bispecific, if I'm not mistaken, and then they have ADCs. I think they have pretty much every biological technology in the pipeline possible, which is especially as the early biotech is pretty surprising.
Yeah. I'm not advocating to be in everywhere, because I think there is a saying in in the US at least, who says how do they call it, master, jack of all trades and master of none. You have to develop some expertise and depth in the areas that you can master, basically. But you have to be open, and I think to look at how to solve, again, biological questions. I think that's the most important thing.
It's Nicholas, it's where's the balance and how to prioritize it. That's the hard part. I guess, not to defend BioNTech, but I guess they're not trying to be everywhere, but it's probably opportunity based. And mRNA, they were super good in mRNA.
100%. Yeah, no, I'm not making any judgment upon them. I think they also have, they were successful and had a lot of money, so they can afford these kind of things with the COVID. So, and we're all very grateful that they've done that, right?
Yes. That's brilliant. One hot topic, but I guess we kind of not have to talk about it, but a bit about AI. And I heard you talking about AI already 2 years ago. And one thing you were focused on was really on the protein engineering optimization. I'm curious how do you translate it to at Immunocore?
Yeah.
If it's specific examples, and what's the scale of that example?
It's a really, I'm so excited to be in this era still, be part of this, because we're going to see a huge transformation with AI in the drug development process, right? So you see it today with monoclonal antibodies, that a lot of the monoclonal antibody starts in the computer, basically, because we understand a lot more about monoclonal antibodies. We are in a very lucky situation where, I told you we've been at it for 20 years, so we know what works and what doesn't work, and we have tons of data. And, when we did the, when we developed the, to look for specificity and how it works, we did everything with co-crystal structures. So we have a resolution of resolved 500, something like that, 500 co-crystal structures. So you can imagine the richness of that data to actually start looking at predicting, what kind of TCR you need to have before even doing experiments in the lab. That's what we're focused on. And I think that's going to cut a lot of time to bring, that's one part where we can actually make a difference there.
And how are you doing it then? Are you training some models yourself? Are you partnering with some?
So we have one collaboration. So we're partnering with one company, and then we have internal efforts as well, because we're sitting on that data. If you imagine, not only the data that I talked about for the crystal structure and everything, but we also now treated 2,000 patients or something like that from clinical trials and everything. So there's a lot of information there as well. Right. So I think we are just at the beginning, but I'm really, really excited about that.
Mm. That's amazing. Because the potential is huge and can be really transformative. I think Bernard Lantada was a previous CEO of Evotech on the show, and he mentioned that the gains, if you look at the industry's drug development, would cut by 30 to 50% the costs of the whole process. And what, as we discussed, when you think in billions and in years, time and money, it's huge.
Yeah, absolutely.
But that's huge on one hand, but I'm also always curious is what you just mentioned, having some concrete, let's say, examples of now, how can it help, especially biotech companies, like as of today or in the shorter term, and how they like integrate it or work with it or profit from it? That's always, I find that's less easy to necessarily see, or not less easy to translate. And that's what also was very interesting to see.
Yeah, there is something really concrete now. Like if you look at some companies going after monoclonal antibodies, nobody does, or at least these companies are not going to immunize llamas or immunize mice or immunize whatever. Look at, you know, that, or have a big phage display library and things like that. You know, in small molecules, it started the same thing, you know, to do the design before. But in monoclonal, it's really, I think, is showing the way there, that basically you do all that modeling in silico, basically. And that's AI, that's basically, you know, based on the information we have about monoclonal antibodies. That's what we're trying to do on the TCR, because if you can cut all that empirical way of finding, you know, doing the testing and finding and all this stuff, these are months. When you cut, you know, a year or something of the drug development, that's a lot of money already to start with. And that's just the beginning. I think once you get, the more you do of this modeling, the more you, you know, educate the system, the better it is, and so on. And then you start, I think there is a company doing that in monoclonal antibodies in a finding a different way of bispecific, just all with AI. That's completely fascinating. So I think we're just at the beginning.
You know the company? What's the name of the?
You know, Biologic, I will say. They're doing that. Yeah.
Yeah, that's it. And maybe, do you have other?
I think Upsilera, I think, as well.
Yeah. Do you have other use cases at Immunocore where you use AI?
Yeah, we just basically the area where we are focused on first is taking all that learning on how we can, before going experimental, find the right TCR, you know, just through that modeling and knowing, because it's not just finding the TCR. If you find the TCR, does it bind correctly? Does it do, and all the stuff? You can do all that now. In silico, like I said, it's the beginning, but we are really working hard on that.
That's good. Well, one thing I'm curious also. One thing mentioned, Thomas Clausel from Oaken was on the show, and he, I asked him actually, okay, what should a biotech platform? How should a biotech platform use AI today? Because obviously it's very, tricky. What we just discussed: should you partner? Should you do your own things? Where to apply it. One thing he said is on the clinical trials, on certification of patients or finding the right patients, where you have massive potential gains as well. Because are you also using AI on, let's say, on optimizing clinical trials?
Not to the same extent, you know, but I think there is potential there, you know, is where to get the data. Like I said, we have 2,000 patients or something dosed, so we know a lot more. And we are trying to use the data to inform us. But, you know, I think where hopefully it will make more of a difference is basically, you know, clinical trials take a long time. Finding the right patients take a long time. If we can cut from that time, you know, and bring the right patients to the trials and so on, you know, it's not an easy thing. And if we're going to do it properly, we're going to have to really collaborate in that space.
Nah. It's not gonna collaborating at the moment. You're looking at it. You're looking at it, I guess, at collaborating.
Correct.
Nice. I think that's amazing discussion. I could continue for a while, but I know we have a time limit. I think I think it's a great wrapping up. I think we can finish here. Thanks a lot, Peter, for joining.
It's my pleasure. Thank you very much.
And please continue amazing work, and keep my fingers crossed that everything works out well and all the data comes out.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. All right.
Thanks, Peter. Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to the end. I have to say, it was one of my favorite episodes so far. I'm impressed by what Baija has been building at Immunocore and how she is doing it with focus on the science, on care about the patients, following her heart, while at the same time she's super down to earth and having fun. I hope you enjoyed as well. If you did, please hit the like, follow, review button. Any of these actions would help us a lot. And I would also be curious to hear what you think. So please leave a comment below or send me an email to philip@flot.io. All right, see you in the next episode.